This is The Brain, and you're listening to the GeekCast Radio Network. Yes!
Hello, welcome to episode 209 of The Cinema Geeks. I am one of your Cinema Geeks, Optimus Solo, and joining me today as the huge, the comic concierge, Dan. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. And today we're going to just keep on trucking through the filmography of Alfred Hitchcock. So you've heard us talk about 39 Steps, Notorious, Rope, and Strangers on a Train. And now we are going to be talking about the 1954 American crime thriller, Dial M for Murder, obviously directed by Alfred Hitchcock, starring Ray Milland, Grace Kelly, Robert Cummings, Anthony Dawson, and John Williams, among some other minor roles. The plot here is that we have as usual for a Hitchcock film, we have a murder or a plan for a murder involved in the story here, and some individuals that are either trying to get away with murder, trying to frame somebody with murder. It is Dial M for Murder, so it makes sense that we're going to talk about that a lot. So, Dan, I know you said you had watched this once. I think it was like maybe 13 years ago.
And then, yes, it was a very long time ago.
Gotcha. And then this is the first rewatch since then. So what was your first reaction to Dial M for Murder on this rewatch?
First, I was surprised like how much I remembered. Like, with Strangers on a Train, some of it clicked with me. But with Dial M for Murder, like, once I started watching it, I was like, okay. I remembered a good amount of it. Like, I was like, okay, a lot of it stuck with me. And honestly, there's a lot of similarities between this and Dial M, or this and Strangers on a Train, as well as Rope. You know, like Rope, it's based on a stage play. It takes place primarily in one location. And then also, like Strangers on a Train, it has a situation where someone's trying to commit the perfect murder, per se. And I really like this once again. I think, even though I didn't like Rope as much, I felt like this felt more claustrophobic than Rope, even though with Rope, we are in one room the entire time, almost always like with one shot. And I also really like the cat and mouse game that's being played here. Like, you have, you know, this individual who is angry with his wife who is having an affair, so he wants to kill her, and he goes through this elaborate concept of trying to get that done by going to like an old college friend that he tracks down and follows in some really creepy ways, but try to blackmail him to do it. And he thinks he has the perfect plan, but I loved how seeing this guy who thinks he has everything figured out, and how it kind of falls apart, but like him trying to put the pieces back again. And then I don't know, I just found that the machinations of the plot, similar to like what I really liked about Strangers on a Train, like you where I felt like I understood everything that was happening and the reasoning behind it. And it was just a really like well constructed concept. The same thing here, and having it all take place in one location, obviously being placed based on a play, you can kind of tell that, but for whatever reason, it felt, I don't know, like we get a little bit of shots outside of it, and we get a couple shots in other locations, but I don't know, I ended up really liking it. How about yourself?
Yeah, so this one, again, this was a first time watch for me, so I'd never seen this one before, knew nothing about it, went in completely blind, and I'm really not familiar too much with the cast as well. Like, I know probably, I guess you could say Grace Kelly's the most famous person we have here.
Yeah.
I would assume the most well-known. And I don't know if I've ever seen her in a movie. I don't have her filmography, like, memorized. I've seen her in Rear Window. So, like, that's another Hitchcock film. But besides that, like, I don't think I've ever seen her hardly in any other film. So it was almost like an introduction to her in a way. But a lot of it has the things that I like, you know, like I like limited set. I like a limited amount of characters. I like something that's going to be driven a lot on dialogue, which is what you get a lot of times when you have a play that's being, you know, transitioned into a film. And I think you pointed out a lot of good parallels between this and some of the other Hitchcock films we've talked about, whether it be Rope or Strangers on a Train, probably the most specific ones, because clearly Hitchcock was interested in exploring this whole idea or aspect of, you know, I use the word murder a lot in kind of the first couple sentences I said on the podcast here, but it's not just a murder. He's like, he's very intrigued or interested in looking at this whole idea of a perfect murder. And so what we get in a number of these films is a little bit unlike what we see more today, where there's a lot of stuff that is more after the fact. So it's more about, like, when you watch a lot of TV series or movies that deal with crime and murder and stuff like that, I feel like a lot of it's more on the other side. Like, it's solving the crime. It's trying to figure out the aftermath of it. Whereas we get a lot in a couple of these films about the planning of it and the setting up of it and the talking our way through it and trying to think of all the different ways that we're going to protect ourselves against getting caught or whatever the case may be. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing that he's explored. And I think, again, what this one does that Strangers on a Train did as well, to me, that separates both of those films a little bit from Rope is the thrilling aspect or the suspense aspect, I think, is, again, on point here. Much like we talked about last episode of Strangers on a Train, because this one had me really not sure what was going to happen next. You know, I wasn't predicting any way that the story was going to go. You know, at one point you're wondering if the murder is going to happen or not. Later on, you're wondering if he's going to get away with it or not. And it just had just enough of, like, not knowing exactly how this is going to resolve, not knowing how all the pieces are going to come together and who's going to, is she going to get in trouble or found guilty of this? Is the, you know, the affair, the love affair with the gentleman, is he going to be involved and get blamed? Is the rightful person going to get blamed? So, like, there is a lot of that that just kind of lends itself to some natural tension and suspense, which I definitely appreciated from that. And the rest of the cast, I didn't know a lot of them. Like, I don't know if I've seen Ray Milland in anything. I don't know if I've seen Robert Cummings in anything, but I loved Robert Cummings in this, who plays Mark Halliday, who is the lover, I guess you could say, of Grace Kelly's character, not the husband. And I thought he did phenomenal. Like, every time he was on screen, I wanted to see more of him. And to see, you can clearly see a dynamic between the two guys here. You said a little bit of a cat and mouse, but it, like, basically, yeah, the cat and mouse between those two as far as who's going to get the upper hand and who's going to, like, Mark Halliday obviously comes across as someone who's intelligent. Correct me if I'm wrong, he's a writer or a reviewer. He deals with crime stories in a way. And so it gives him, like, not an expertise, but, like, an inner knowledge, I guess, of, like, in his mind, like, the things that you need to look forward to in order to solve a mystery, because he's written about them or reviewed. Was he the writer himself of books?
Yeah, he was a crime. He was a writer and author of crime stories. So you could even say, like, it, you know, not like a insert of Alfred Hitchcock, but certainly, like, one where you could see some parallels, because there was almost like a meta aspect of some of the stuff he was saying, obviously, like, where he was talking about, you know, how things never go right and, like, how, like, things seem a lot easier in the movies. And then, of course, he's like, well, in real life, things would, you know, every little small things would happen that wouldn't go the way you're expecting. And then right after that is exactly what ends up happening. You know, we see from her not wanting to stay home that night and, like, issues with the key. Yeah, you know, I like that one. Being meta, breaking the fourth wall wasn't super uncommon. Like, Bob Hope did it all the time during this era, but right. I thought it added a little bit something that we haven't seen in this retrospective in a Hitchcock film yet.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, when Tony, which is the character played by Ray Milland, he's like the main, he's her husband. When he's laying out his plan for exactly how this is going to go, which is, you know, it's right in front of us. He's literally telling somebody else step by step what you need to do, what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, like, all this other stuff. And when he's telling that whole story, it's so easy to just follow the dots that he's laying out and think, that he has conceived of maybe a perfect plan, or that like this is actually going to be super easy. And it's interesting because his performance and the way he portrays that, it's just, you just buy into it. You're like, yeah, he's thought of everything. This is how it's going to work. And for me, like, I didn't even like think of the plan and in the way that Mark Halliday probably would have, and be like, it's going to take the most minute thing that you have no control over to make this plan go wrong. Like, and for some reason you don't pick up on that as he's laying it all out. At least I didn't. Like, that it could be something as simple as, like, she doesn't want to stay home, and then your whole plan's ruined.
Yeah.
And there's, like, a series of maybe, like, a half a dozen things that go, maybe not a half a dozen, but there's a number of things that are going wrong or have the potential to go wrong that we just, like, immediately see, like, one after the other. And it's like, oh, that whole plan that sounded genius wasn't even close. Like,
yeah.
So many ways this can go wrong.
His watch goes, stops working. There's someone in the phone booth when he goes out, you know.
Right. And then the person that he relies everything and counts on is clearly not capable of doing what he was asking him to do, in a way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
Did you notice, like, I didn't, honestly, even on rewatch, I didn't realize he put the key back under the carpet. I guess I did
not notice at all, but it was weird because I'm watching this for the first time and he's doing the sequence and he gets in the room and all of that. And when Tony comes back, like, obviously he is looking for the key. And I'm thinking to myself, like, the whole plan, like, if I'm that guy, like, the plan should have been to open that and put that key right back. Like, you shouldn't have brought the key in with you. Like, this hall could have been avoided if you just put the key back. I'm like, this was something they didn't think of, and I had no idea that that was actually going to be part of the plot the rest of the way.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, like, he did exactly what I thought he should have done, but I totally didn't pick up on the fact that he actually did that. So that was kind of interesting. And I just think, I don't know, I do like the way the story unfolds. I like the way that it's, like, slowly revealed each thing that could go wrong. And then at one point, like, the chief inspector in this is an interesting character.
Yeah.
I don't know 100% how I feel about him as a character or as the performance, because he had me going in different directions. Like, I was like, oh, this character is awful and, like, completely incompetent. But then at the other point, you're like, oh, he's a genius. But then he's not being played as a genius. Like, he was almost like the Columbo of this, where, like, he's totally throwing everybody off by coming across as someone who's not really on top of it. So, like, we basically have Columbo in the chief inspector, and I guess you could call Mark Halliday, like, Jessica Fletcher, like, for Murder, She Wrote. Like, he's the writer that, like, is going to be able to solve everything. So it's interesting, like, that you have sort of those types of structures of characters involved here. Not that that was, obviously, this came way before all of that. So, but it was an interesting dynamic, and I don't know what your take of the inspector's character was, but he had me kind of all over the place throughout this movie on if I liked him, didn't like him, thought he was doing a good job, thought he was doing a bad job. Like, what was your take on him?
I did like the fact he was very antagonistic, but, like, in an interesting way. Like, he, like, kind of asking all those questions, and, like, not taking anything. I did feel like the way that they were so accepting that she murdered him without, like, just without, you know, like, with not buying her story. Mm-hmm. That was, like, I don't know. Like, it seems like they're really out to, like, get her for murder. But I also, like, thought it made sense in the way they put the pieces together. Like, it's like, oh, like, you know, and he of course, didn't help much. I do think, though, he just kind of come around and it just become a bit convenient. You know, there are elements of that, of course. But I thought he was at least good foil, and I thought, you know, the way he seems to be having fun with it, in a way, he was very, I don't know, I won't say cartoonish, but certainly, like,
well, I mean, based on that final shot,
he does got the great mustache, I gotta give him that. So I thought, you know, his character was certainly there to be the person to kind of move things around, and he does make a show of everything. And in a lot of ways, which I thought was kind of interesting, but
I agree with you though too. Like, the way that Mark Halliday is, like, it caught me off guard because he explained something to me. Like, obviously, I guess you have to make the leap that he actually has put together exactly what has happened and is just right on. yeah. as he's explaining like to Tony, like this is what you should tell him, and it's like exactly what happened. But like his whole story though, and then when they relay that or say it in front of the inspector, and they all act like this is like the most outlandish, like nobody's gonna believe that this is a crazy story, and I'm like, what part of that story was crazy? Like everything made sense that he just said, and it's not outlandish. Maybe it was outlandish at that time. I don't know. I feel like somebody comes across the police and tells that story, and I don't know. I can't imagine today the police just being like, "Oh, you're full of baloney."
You would think he would be a little bit more suspicious over the fact that, because he knew about the letter, so he kind of knew his wife and him were having that affair. And then he's just like, yeah, we're still friends, though, right? We're just going to... It seems like he would be completely unaware of the animosity that would exist just because of what was happening. It's like, yeah, like, you'd want to kill her because of this happening. It's like, yeah, that probably would be a good reason. You put those pieces together, so...
What did you think of the interaction between Tony, who's obviously, again, we're talking about the main... antagonist in this film, I guess you'd call him. What did you think about his scene with Anthony Dawson's character, who plays Charles Swan, who is who he hires to do this murder? Then they have a interesting sequence where he invites him over to the whatever we're calling this, the apartment, the flat, the house, whatever they're staying at, and under the auspices of he's trying to buy a car from him, and then kind of weaves his way to like almost entrap him into like forcing him to be a part of this plan. And it's a similar dynamic to obviously in Strangers on a Train, where we have one person trying to convince another person to be a part of this, but it's not the main character. It's like a side character he's trying to convince. And it's a pretty elongated sequence, a little bit of sometimes you'd get in trouble for that, like these days, where it's like too much of the plot being told between the two characters, I guess. But what did you think about that whole sequence between those two characters and how it's all laid out?
Yeah, I mean, this could easily just be an audio play on it, like, because it's everything is told through dialogue. Like, you could not even like watch the screen and like you get everything, because everything is very direct. I think it works because you have good performances, and that whole soliloquy of him going through everything, it does. Made him very conniving, and I do. There's also this running thread of a lot of the movies where I feel like Hitchcock doesn't like this type of intellectual who feels like they're the smartest person in the room and is always talking down to everyone. Because you see those characters a lot in this, in his movies thus far that we've gone over, and they're often, they have this demeanor that seems like they are highfalutin, but obviously really awful human beings. We saw that, of course, with Rope. We even saw that with Strangers on the Train. And now this, of course, because, Tony is like, he's a tennis pro. But I thought it was a good, well-constructed scene. It put all the pieces together. Everything made sense. And it was, the direction of it was, it's a lot happening there, right? Because like you said, it's a lot of dialogue. It's going through a lot of backstory. It's the opposite of show, don't tell. It's telling you, not really showing you much. But I thought the actors made it work. And even Hitchcock, not overusing camera movements, never became a distraction. Like, you felt you were in the room with them. So go ahead.
I think it also helped because we not only are convinced because of Tony's kind of delivery of like how much he's thought of this, but then it also then brings in this Swan character who is raising his own questions, like, have you thought of this, or you forgot about this, or this detail is going to screw you up. So it even adds another layer to convince you that like this is almost foolproof, just to completely deconstruct that immediately, like 17 times in the next like 10 minutes after that. So it's like interesting though, like I think that sequence does a good job of just like cementing that this is actually a legit fail-safe plan, that all of the contingencies have been thought of, and I bought into it hook, line, and sinker like an idiot, not even like thinking like how many holes there was. And I thought it was like a genius way to kind of like, it's not just one guy that thinks he knows all the answers. We have another guy that's then questioning him, and they're still showing that like everything's been thought of. And I thought that was an interesting way to kind of like build that up in a way that, like, as it gets deconstructed, it makes it like even that much more effective to me, I think.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think it that was a good way of approaching it. And I think that scene, it has to work, because if it doesn't work, nothing that comes next is going to. And,
right.
And it kind of set the stage. And that really is a scene. This movie is really like three scenes for the most part. I mean, you get the opening, that is the bulk of the film, and then of course you have the murder scene, and then the follow-out. And
with the inspector, yeah.
Yeah, it is a lot of long, prolonged scenes, and it's just interesting watching this after Rope and how we both didn't like it as much, and just trying to figure out like what worked here more. And I think it just came down to the characters and the dynamic, it being a bit more compelling, and obviously and feeling like there was the direction like made me feel more part of the film where I wasn't distracted.
You know, right.
I never felt like the movie never made itself aware. Make it like self aware. It was a movie, even though it did have like some of the kind of all close to meta jokes when it came to like, you know, the author talking about how you do crime film. But it's just there is clearly a lot of connecting tissue between all the movies we've gotten so far.
Well, and it's also interesting because so far in all three of those films, well, really in every film except for Notorious, every film has had one of the main, I guess, murders or deaths happen very quickly.
Yeah.
Even 39 Steps, the girl's killed in the apartment, like in the first quarter of the film, right? Like that sets up the stage for everything. Rope, it's like the opening sequence. Strangers on a Train, it happens in the first third. This one, it happens, you know, probably right around the third mark. So it's interesting how they do that. But then each film has a completely different way to then navigate the rest of the story or the rest of the film.
Yeah. And
I think that's why one of the main reasons why for Rope it doesn't work for me as much as it has in these other ones was because in that one, they killed the person immediately, which is the quickest out of all the films. So we don't have any really build up to the actual action. It just happens without warning and without any thought of, you know, character build or the situation build or anything. So that's the one. But then I think the other one is Rope, for the most part, then ignores the death for the better part of the film, right? Like,
yeah,
we know the two characters know about it. Nobody else does. Nobody's trying to solve anything necessarily. And it just kind of like continues on with like not the death being like the main crux, I think, for me, whereas all these other ones, it has been like the one, you know, in 39 Steps, he's trying to prove his innocence. He's on the run. Like, it's a big part of the rest of the film. In Strangers on a Train, like, it sets up the whole dynamic between these two characters and the cat and mouse between them and trying to get him to do another murder, to, you know, repay the favor. And then this one, obviously, we're trying to figure out who's going to get blamed for it, who's going to get, you know, found guilty for it. So I think I don't know, it works so much better in all these other ones for me. And I think that's one of the things that makes it way more suspenseful and more of a thriller. Not that I want to keep like piling on Rope. It's not like the worst movie ever or anything like that.
No, it's ugly duckling of the what we right. watched so far, but it's just interesting comparing it. But it's also interesting, like with all the murders that are such a central focus, is that what they're being, well, 39 Steps was probably the murder that had the most stakes because it was dealing with espionage, and I guess Notorious didn't necessarily have a central murder, but like the other ones, it's not over money, it's not, you know, it's always based upon love affairs, and it's always that is leading to the murder thus far, and it's never, you know, which is, you know, because you think of, obviously this is the time of a lot of crime films and things like that, but all these murders are based upon personal relationships, or in the case of Rope, just the desire to do it. Like it's the murder itself, what that is, that kind of thing they're trying to achieve, rather not necessarily out of something that is like more right. Materialistic. So,
yeah. And it makes it harder to relate to in a way too, because you're like, I can't relate to the college, you know, the college kid who's just trying to prove he can commit the perfect murder compared to somebody who is, you know, their spouse is cheating on them, or their spouse is kind of like keeping the, holding them ransom for moving on with their life, or, you know, things of that nature. So I think it's harder, you know, on one, just to like relate and like put yourself in that story. It seems like it's artificial from the get go in a way, unless you're talking about something like, you know, a true, like, it seems like that only works if you're dealing with somebody that's like a serial killer or something like that, where there's no, like, you know, like a Silence of the Lambs or something, like, you know, it, then it's a whole different ball game. But I do find it interesting how he's played with the idea of a perfect murder from a couple different angles here. Try to see if it does, you know, if it's a thing, does it exist? Can you achieve it type thing? He was obviously curious or found it as an interesting subject matter for a number of his films so far. So it's kind of interesting to see him explore it, I guess, in a yet another different way in Dial M for Murder.
Yeah.
What did you think of the, so obviously we do have the inspector and we do have the Swan character who commits the murder or attempts to commit the murder, I guess I could say. What did you think of the main three though? So we have Tony and Margot and Mark as like the main three characters. It's like a trio there, not just in the love triangle aspect, but in the fact that they are in every scene has one of them in it. And how do you think that trio, do you think they worked together? Do you think their chemistry was there? Do you think they kind of balanced each other out? Did one stand out more than another for you? Or kind of how did you feel like from the main three actors and actress, how they worked?
I thought Grace Kelly and Robert Cummings had pretty good chemistry. Like, we only, you know, we see them in that opening scene together, and they do feel like, you know, they're really, you can see, you know, they feel like two people that could possibly be in love. And then even when they're in the scene and they're with Tony Ray in that scene together where they're sitting on the couch and he's behind them, it's just, there's this, even though it's not really directed, there's this weird tension, like where you could just, like, everyone in the room knows what the situation is. And I thought they kind of played that well. I do wish Grace Kelly got a bit more to do. Obviously, she's absent for a good chunk of the film because she ends up getting arrested and whatnot. But I thought, like, she gave you that, I mean, it obviously, you know, it's this time where the woman's always the victim, but that is the case here, but she also, I think, you know, seeing her being able to, you know, overcome the perfect murder, because, you know, she literally takes things into her own hands. So I thought the chemistry was good where it shouldn't be, and then she didn't really have much chemistry with Tony at all. But that was purposeful, of course. They didn't feel like they, like, I don't know, they didn't connect whatsoever. So I thought them together was, again, a big part of what worked for me.
Yeah, I think you hit it right in the head, and I didn't even think about that beforehand. But the chemistry between Kelly and Cummings, like, they made that 100% believable that that was a true relationship, and that each one truly felt for the other person, and that there was like a love connection, which makes that work, because you're always trying to figure out, like, from Mark Halliday character standpoint, how he's going to walk the line in all of these sequences where he's in the same room or out, you know, in a social setting with Tony, hearing about things that's happening to Margot. He can't overplay his hand necessarily. Like, he can't do what he probably wants to do inside to make sure she's okay and to, like, do all these different things. So it's like an interesting way that he's playing that. And I think it makes it like 100% believable, because you can, like, see it in his face. Like, even when Tony leaves the stag party or whatever you called it, and, you know, Mark can kind of tell that something's wrong, but he also, and you can tell that he, like, wants to know and wants to be there for her. But at the same time, you know, he knows he has to play his part at this point. And so I thought that was an interesting dynamic. And I think it really worked, like you said, like, because you could see if there had been chemistry between Margot and Tony's character, they don't play it in this sequence because by that point, you know, the love is gone between those two. So I thought they did a nice job of making that all very believable.
Do you know what he was making her, like, when he, like, she was doing the clippings, was she, like, cutting out stories about him in the paper, like, and collecting them? Because, like, that is kind of a crummy thing to do. It's like, okay, well, if you stay here, collect stories, cut out newspaper articles about me, I'm gonna go out and have fun with my friends, like, that, you know. It's like, man, you are a jerk, man. But
yeah, that whole sequence where he's, like, freaking out because she's not wanting to stay home, it was a hard one, because you're like, how are you gonna get through this? Because it's weird when your only play is like stay home and clip these things out. And do, you know, like it wasn't like it was a weird sell. Like, and then she went for it because I guess it's a movie and she has to. But it was like, I don't know if that was the most convincing pitch you just gave her on why she should stay home. So
yeah, at first, like it had me thinking. I was like, wait, did she and Mark have something planned? That's why she wanted to go out. Like that almost like the way she was so insistent about it. Like, was she thinking about, I don't know, but it was, again, it just showed, it went back to that speech about how like every little thing could go wrong. And it just hinted at things are not going as planned and, you know, nice little bit of foreshadowing.
Right. And I felt dumb because the whole idea of a key factors into this movie, like 10 times. Like there's so many different sequences where we're talking about a key, looking at a key, trying to figure out which key is where, who's got what key and whatnot. And through that whole thing, I still didn't, even though I had decided in my head, if I was in that position, I would have put it right back on the steps. Mm-hmm. I still never connected the dots as to that being important later, or as that being like a crux of this story and how it resolves itself. Like it totally blindsided me in a cool way. I was like, oh yeah.
You think it's going to be the phone, right? Because it's dial and border. Like, oh, the phone's going to be a big thing. And then,
yeah, I feel like Key should have been in the name of the movie instead of the phone.
Yeah. I mean, Hitchcock loves his trinkets. It's the lighter. It's the. It's always like something like, you know.
At least this one was a little bit more believable. Like the lighter to me is still problematic because I still don't buy like how that's going to like be what do they call it? The
smoking gun.
Yes, the smoking gun. Thank you. I was like, it's got a gun in it. The phrase I'm looking for has a gun in it. is this the most Hitchcockian film we've seen so far? So what I'm saying by that is, I think outside of having a mother involved, it hits almost everything else. So we have the Hitchcock blonde here. We have the person that is being thought of as guilty who is not. It's a little bit of a different take on that because she's guilty and then taken out of the movie for a minute and it's somebody else that's trying to like show her innocence. So that's, I guess, a slight variation on that. We have the idea of strangling and murder and the perfect murder. Like there's so many different aspects that we've seen in all the other movies that it feel like they're all here except for a mom character.
Yeah. Although I bet that Tony has mom issues. I'm just gonna assume. Seems like he might. So,
but it is interesting because they do hit a lot of it. We do get, you know, like I said, it's and every murder has to be. There has to be a rope involved or a strangling aspect.
It's always strangulation. Like I guess you know we'll get to, you know, when people are using stabbing, but yeah, it's always strangulation. Right. I guess I'm guessing because it's. I don't know if that was a censor thing as well, or it's just more dramatic, but...
I mean, they did show a scissors to the back, so...
They did. That was pretty brutal. I was in, like...
And he lands on it.
Yeah. It's like, oh, it went deeper.
And it seemed like they somehow did that with the... Like, the way they filmed that looked like it actually did go deeper.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. And even though you can't see it.
I'm guessing maybe it was a dummy, or I think maybe the jacket had padding on it or something like that would be my guess.
It was interesting. I did not see that coming at first.
And there was a nice little line, too, about I thought there'd be more blood. And I was like, I wonder if that's like Hitchcock saying, you know, speaking about, you know, the censorship of the day where it's like he very limited. Like if he showed more blood, they wouldn't let him make it. And I don't know if that was like if that was a purposeful line or if that was just a throwaway. I don't know.
Yeah, it definitely seems like, I don't know. I feel like this movie from beginning to end just feels, I don't know. It feels like a complete movie to me. Not that the other ones aren't, they all are, but like something about this one just felt like, I don't know, like everything was exactly how it was supposed to be. And it felt like, you know, I made a comment, I think when we were watching Strangers on a Train that I felt like we had leveled up to like a new quality of movies. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like this one does the same thing. Like it's like this is a movie through and through. Like I can see exactly how this would work at that time period with everything that's involved. Like I don't know. Like I can't find a ton to say in a negative manner for this one. I'm not saying it's like the favorite one that I've watched so far. I don't know. I'm still debating that in my head. But like it just felt like there wasn't a whole lot of like things you could really nitpick outside of the fact that it does come across a little bit, especially with the professor, or not the professor, the inspector.
Yeah.
As if you're watching someone on stage with, and you know, typically when you're on a stage, you're going to overact in certain ways, or you're going to be a little bit more melodramatic or that type of thing. So you can see like some hints of that, which I guess makes sense since it's being adapted from a stage play. But what was your kind of take on just the overall structure and execution of the film as a film?
If that makes sense. It feels very, very confident in itself. Like it feels like a movie that, like it's, like I said, like there's so much on the dialogue. There's so much placed on the actors, and Hitchcock trusted the actors to get it done. And I think if you had lesser actors or people who were, and like each actor, I think it's also good, great casting, because I do feel like they fit those roles well. And even if it was a little not as strong in any area, the movie comes apart. And because a lot of it, like we mentioned, is you need those characters to have chemistry, because if they don't have chemistry early on, like that, then doesn't really have much. And you need kind of Grace Kelly and Ray Miller to have kind of an awkward relationship, and that comes to play. And even the actor who was the murderer, he felt like a con man, in the way it was approached. So I thought it was done. Like it is a lot of dialogue. It does take its time to kind of explain everything, and maybe it gets more complex. And not more complex may not be the right word, but it does. It's maybe a little bit in love with itself a bit, and like how it likes to like explain everything, but. I was fascinated by it. I enjoyed just the creation of the, like, how everything came together, and then trying to find a way to figure out actually what happened, and seeing everyone try to like approach it a different way, and how a little thing like a key comes into play. So yeah. I thought it all worked for me.
And I think it also did what a lot of the other films have done for me so far, which is it grabbed my interest almost from the first scene. Or the first few minutes type thing. Like it had my attention, and I think it worked at a pace where I never had a time where I was like thinking about something else other than the movie. Like it didn't have those like lulls where you're taken out of the movie, or where something, like I thought the pace was quick enough and there was enough to like be interested in that. Like once it hooked me, I was just like, I'm not going to try to say like on this, edge of my seat or something like that, but it was just something that I was like, still, I'm interested in every sequence and how this is playing out. And I thought that is something that I've noticed on quite a few of his films, is it gets you early and then it moves at a brisk enough pace where I feel like there wasn't a time for you to be like, falling asleep.
An effective score too. Like there wasn't a lot of score, and because like we mentioned, it's a lot of conversations. But especially when we see the murder attempted murder take place. It came in at the right moments, and it exaggerated those pieces as much as it should. So we even talked about scores a lot with this, but
right.
This one I just didn't really notice them that much, but for this I did, because there was so much conversation when it was quiet. It was a bit off, and the score became that much more noticeable.
Totally get that, yeah. And then, it's somewhat surprising to me, I think this is one of the lower rated ones. Like, on Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 90%, which I know is still good. I want to say most of the other ones have been higher than that. I don't have them in front of me to, like, compare. And then the consensus on that site is Dial M for Murder, maybe slightly off peak Hitchcock, which, it's surprising to me to hear that. And then there's quite a few negative reviews that are more modern, I guess, that people have written about it, which surprises me a little bit. Like one of them says, like, the chief weakness is that the action is slow.
It is slow, but I mean, I guess, but it, if it isn't like, but I didn't mind it. I felt it was,
I guess the action may be slow. I guess it depends on what you're looking for. Like, I don't consider a lot of dialogue to me to be slow necessarily, depending on how the dialogue's delivered and what it is, I guess. But I don't know. I guess I never felt it was slow going through there, but I guess you can see that it's somewhat, as far as like, there's not a ton that happens action wise outside of dialogue. Yeah. Like there's a trip to a party, and there's a, a murder attempt. And then there's, the inspector trying to solve things, but there's not a whole lot of action that's going to take place from the beginning to the end. So I guess I can see it if that's what you're looking for and you're needing something that's like going to go, but I felt it was fine for me.
If you were to watch like North by Northwest and then Ness, I could see like it feeling slow, but it's a different type of film. It's a movie that's more about the situation and reasoning behind everything more so than the thrills per se. So
I did not catch the Alfred Hitchcock cameo in this one. I had to look it up. Did you?
Catch I did. Yeah, when he shows the yearbook.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, and I caught it this time, and I caught it for Strangers on a Train. Strangers on the Train's a little easier because you see.
Yeah, Strangers on a Train was pretty easy, but this one was it in the yearbook and in the picture on the wall? Was he one of the people at one of the tables?
Yes, that's it. It was not the yearbook. Okay. It was the picture on the wall. Yes. Yeah.
So I did not catch it because I was looking for like an actual like person that was moving around, and I'm like, well, there's nobody else in this film. Like, we've met everybody except for. I guess I was like, do I need to go back to that party that they were at?
Yeah.
They showed like a few tables. Is he at there somewhere? But it's just on the picture on the wall. So clever Hitchcock. You got me on that one. So any other pieces of trivia or information that you had found for this one or that we haven't got a chance to talk about yet for Dial In for Murder?
What's interesting is actually, speaking, we were talking about how it's a lot of conversation. It was actually originally slated to be a 3D film. Like it was, they wanted to make it, and put it in 3D, but like by the time it came out, 3D was kind of came and gone, as if we kind of knew that was going to happen yet again. So that like that was intriguing because it made me think about I don't know what 3D would add to this. Maybe right. The only thing I could think of is that scene of with her holding her hand out. You know, that's obviously on the poster, but like that. But that I found kind of interesting was that it was meant to be 3D, and also like. When it came to Grace Kelly's costuming, she was able to kind of have a lot of decisions behind it. Like when she came down to like answer the phone, originally she was supposed to wear like a kind of this like really big robe and stuff like that. But she said that a woman wouldn't put a huge robe on just to answer the phone. And Alfred Hitchcock just said, all right, we'll go with it. And that's what they did. So
I like it. So, yep, that is the latest movie that we've been talking about, which is Dial M for Murder, and our thoughts on that. If you agree or disagree, you can leave us comments on the website or in any of our social media, which we'll get to in a few minutes. Now, Dan, we are going into the stage because this is what, the fifth or sixth film we've covered. I can't remember now. So 39 Steps, Notorious, Strangers on the Train, Rope, and Dial M for Murder. So this is number five. So we're next going into what I think many would consider be the big two. So the next one on the schedule is going to be Rear Window. And then after that is Vertigo. So obviously we've both seen both of those films. So it'll be interesting because this will be the first time that we're both doing, I guess, more recent rewatches of this with some history to go along with it. So I'm interested to see, because I know leading up to this, I've always been someone who's championed Rear Window over Vertigo, and I'm interested to see if that holds true as we watch them the next couple weeks, or if I switch. Have you been in one camp or the other in the past, or do you just like both of them equally?
I've always been more Rear Window. When I first watched Vertigo, I wasn't the biggest fan of it. I think
neither was I, actually, so that's interesting.
And I think It's also because it's one of those things when you like it's, but like I think it was the what is the AFI's top movie of all time. Mm-hmm. So anytime you kind of put that type of label on something, it's like it's almost like can you ever live up? But that was also again like 13 years ago. So I loved Rear Window when I first saw it. So I'm interested to see like what it's like now rewatching it again, especially after kind of going through so many of these films beforehand, like how it compares to what we saw so far.
I'm very interested to watch them in this context, because once upon a time my mom and I were trying to go through some of the AFI top 100 lists, and we watched a number of the classics, and we had watched, I think that was the first time I had watched Vertigo, and at first I was like, I don't get it, I didn't understand why it was as lauded as much as it was. And then we watched Rear Window after that at some point, and I was like, well, this is the one that should be in that. This is the one that everybody should be talking about. Like, what are we doing here? So I'm very interested to see if that holds true or not, because it has definitely been at least a decade since I've seen either one. So I'm very interested into that. And then if you want to know which ones we're going to be finishing off with after that, we're still going to be covering North by Northwest, Psycho, and The Birds. So those are the three that we'll be finishing up with. Dan, why don't you tell everybody how they can get in contact with you or leave comments for you or find other content that you're creating?
You can just search for Comic Concierge on Facebook, Twitter, TikTok. Hopefully, I haven't put out video in a long time, but hopefully in a bit, but hopefully we'll be getting back to that soon by the time this is coming out. So
absolutely. You can stay in touch with anything else I do, which is not a lot right now on social media, but my handle is at Optimus Solo, or you can look at some of the other content I've created at the Geek Showcase on YouTube. And you can comment to the actual show if you just find the Cinema Geeks tag on Twitter or Facebook. We're on both of those. I'll still call it Twitter. That's fine. You can yell at me later. And so that's the best way to do that. And then if you want to also keep in touch with all the stuff the main website does, you can search out Geekcast Radio Network, and they have all kinds of geeky content, cartoons and video games and other movie talk and all kinds of stuff like that. So you can look for that as well. So that does it for this episode. Tune in next time for another chance to listen to more of the Cinema Geeks.